Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by Murad Idris, and he is the author of War for Peace, Genealogies of a Violent Ideal in Western and Islamic Thought. This book was published by Oxford University Press in 2019, and it is a fascinating exploration through political thought and thinking about the concept of peace and oftentimes how it is binarily connected to other concepts. But I'm going to let Murad tell us a little bit about that, as well as a little bit about himself and how he came to this project. Hello, Murad, and welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on here, Lily. I really appreciate it. My name is Murad Idris, and I'm an assistant professor of political theory at the University of Virginia. And War for Peace started out as my dissertation, which I started writing in 2009. It's pretty heavily revised since then, but the core impulse, you could say, is the same. And I think that's probably one thing that says quite a bit about me. When I started writing the book, when I started writing the manuscript, the U.S. was in the midst of a war on terror. I'd actually only arrived to the U.S. a couple of years before that. And this language of war for the sake of peace was one that we saw both in official state discourses, in popular media, and also in some, let's say, scholarly and public intellectual spaces. There were a lot of really important critiques of war, and specifically of this war, of the very framing that it had, but the way that the idea of peace was being deployed, that was left intact. There were a number of critiques that actually seemed to hold up peace as the kind of critical aspiration. And to me, that seemed to be missing something pretty dramatic. So peace was either being elided or it was being held up. And so we didn't really look at its implication in war. And I think something analogous happens in different contexts across the globe. Although the book doesn't talk about this much, the question of Israel and Palestine is a kind of clear one. Part of all of this had to do with how across these contexts, it's quite frustrating to see how the language of peace, and specifically the idea that we all have to desire peace, that there's a kind of impossible demand that is imposed only on, let's say, certain groups. So it's an asymmetrical demand. To avow your commitment to peace, that at the end of the day, you are pro-peace, not against peace, even though it's that very opposition in a way that I think does a lot of the troubling work and allows our ideals like peace to bleed into war and to facilitate and also sanitize different kinds of violence. So you could say that the impulse behind the book was to invite readers to look at peace as a problem.
And that's, I mean, this, you do an amazing sort of exploration that was, as I was saying before we started recording, not exactly where I thought the book was necessarily going to be going. But the exploration of the concept and the terminology of peace And again, it's, you know, as you say, it's this term that we are always using, that we're always supposedly striving towards, in politics and in our lives and in religion and so forth. But how does it, one of the points that you make is it's almost never existing by itself. It is a term and a concept that is constantly connected to something else. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you started to see this sort of concept within political thought in particular, because you start out talking about how we see, you know, how you sort of wrote this book in the context of the United States being involved in a number of wars and a variety of other violent situations around the globe. But you go back into ancient political theory as, to some degree, one of the starting points. Can you talk a little bit about the concept itself and to some degree how you started to look into political theory as your guide to thinking about it?
Yes. Yeah, thank you. So when I was noticing these kinds of, let's say, political questions, these global political questions, I was also reading, I was reading Plato. I was reading,
as one does.
Yeah, exactly. I was reading at that point the Laws, and really fell in love with the text. I was reading Carl Schmitt. I was reading Hobbes, Kant, Said Qutb, and a couple of other people. And in part, there was this disconnect or this that dissonance almost between how the language of peace seemed to sort of our intuitions, you could say, in I don't know if it's in political theory or in modernity writ large or something, but general intuitions about peace seems to be that it's a, I mean, like I said earlier, who's against peace? I mean, there's a way of perhaps there's a chapter waiting to be written that's about the impossibility of being against peace or of being critical of peace. And what I found really fascinating as I was reading these different thinkers is the extent to which they were either actively theorizing or you could say implicitly leaning on some constellation of peace and surrounding ideas. And this is one of the three big arguments that I make in the book, that peace is a parasitical concept. It doesn't appear on its own. So whether it's peace and friendship or peace and law or peace and development, peace and order, peace and security, you have all of these different ways that it's almost as though talking about peace on its own strikes speakers and theorists as insufficient. And I became really curious about this insufficiency in the idea of peace by people that are championing it, in a sense. So I started noticing how in Plato, for example, you have the Athenian stranger and Cleinias and Megalus, these three interlocutors. They're talking about peace and war and whether there is any such thing that can be called peace. And at the end of the day, they say there is because of fraternity and because of friendship. So they end up with the formula, you could say, that we need to talk about peace and friendship and fraternity. When you look at Hobbes, you end up with something similar, like, can peace really stand up on its own? And it turns out that when we talk about peace and security and peace and commerce and peace and order, we end up with a kind of peace that can. But these additives or these things that are constellated repeatedly in relation to peace end up not only they don't exactly support it, nor are they naturally associated with it. They end up simultaneously providing it with content, and it ends up sanitizing them so that we don't look at the ways in which these different concepts aren't always so peaceful, how in fact it's through the association of peace and friendship, for example, in the laws, that you end up with friends being those who eat together, but also those who go to war alongside one another against others. So these additives actually end up, I think at one point in the book, I call them hinges. I usually call them, I try coining this term, insinuates. But they're really hinges.
Yeah,
that
I
open
saw
up
that
to
and
two
I was wondering
ends.
How to say it.
Yeah, at least that's how I try to, but yeah.
And that was one of the fascinating points of sort of the opening of your discussion of how peace is, it has to be connected, because apparently it's very hard. I think this is part of what you're talking about in the book. It's very hard to conceptualize it without it being insinuated in relation to something else. Mm-hmm. And I wanted you to explain a little bit about that sort of concept of, as you say, you have the three sort of ways that you see it most commonly connected. Can you talk to those three sort of conceptual frameworks that you're using in the book and then, you know, with regard to the authors that you're bringing in your evaluation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. So let me say something about the idea of conceptualizing peace on its own, because oftentimes the debate surrounding peace has tended to take this kind of form of, like, is peace understood negatively, purely as the absence of something, whether it's the absence of war or the absence of structural forms of violence, or is it understood positively as being peace and all of these other sets of things, friendship law, etc. And part of what's actually interesting to me is how in the supposed negative understanding of peace that even there, there's a lot of content that is oftentimes being smuggled in. So if Thomas Hobbes, who I write about in one of the chapters, in chapter 5, alongside Ibn Khaldun. So if Thomas Hobbes is often propped up as the theorist who tries to give us an understanding of peace simultaneously as the most basic human desire, but also as the absence of war. Part of what I try to show is how when we read him more closely, we see that he's actually smuggling in all sorts of different ideas, ideals, practices, and assumptions about humanity into this notion of peace. And that's the argument that peace is or that it functions parasitically, that it functions in relation to these other concepts that I want us to look at more critically. The second argument that I make by taking these different sets of thinkers together is that peace is a provincial idea. And what I mean by that is it's the dominant theorizations of peace across, let's say, the canon and canon adjacent work has tended to treat peace as a universal human desire, as one that aspires to capture the globe within its discursive orbit, one that is fundamentally about what it means to be human, and one that presents certain kinds of entities, whether it's the polis with Plato or the modern state for modern thinkers, as the natural spaces and the natural agents for peace. And part of what I try to shows how across all of these different thinkers, we actually should pay attention to the anxieties, the desires, the fears, the asymmetries in how the globe is drawn, or in the relationship of different peoples to one another, where they're actually placed in a kind of asymmetrical hierarchy. So that's what I mean when I say the piece is embedded in provincial discursive structures, and that it functions provincially. And finally, the third argument along these lines, and I must apologize to readers for the alliteration, is the piece functions polemically. And I don't mean that in the more, let's say, clear way that someone can, that piece can be, a lot of people will say peace can be abused, it can be misused when someone says, oh, these enemies are against peace. But part of my argument is that the recurrence of that particular discursive form isn't actually an accident at all. That the idealization of peace as something that comes to define particular groups of people, the ones who basically present themselves as being pro-peace in some way, that along with that comes the idea that certain groups are against peace. And the idea of being against peace in this sense is actually cooked into the concept, in that either their political economy or their political form or their history or their religion or their relationship to what it means to be human, these are oftentimes placed by different theorists as the very architecture, in a way, of what it means to think about peace as an ideal. So some people are structurally, in a sense, placed outside of peace. And in this sense, the way that I put it in the book is peace was crafted as a weapon, and it can be redeployed as a weapon against other enemies.
And the weaponization of peace seems something that's an odd idea in and of itself, but it's one that you're also sort of talking about within the initial conversation or the introduction into the book, as you note that these days in contemporary society, in the West in particular, certain groups are called upon to articulate a commitment to peace, whereas other groups are not so called. And I assume that was also part of the impetus for starting to explore this concept.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's actually, it takes a couple of different forms. And in the introduction, I try to gesture towards them. So one is right after 9/11, there was this discourse that I'm also writing on now for a different project, writing on more directly, this discourse that Islam is a religion of peace, or that Islam means peace. And it was an interesting discourse because it's one that was presented as a kind of demand, right, where Muslims who wanted to speak in public, who wanted to appear in public, they would either present this as a kind of a speech tax, in a sense, something that they needed to say in order to be allowed to continue to speak, and in order to indicate to others that they are in fact human, right? Not simply that they are good Muslims, but also that they are human. And I think we see a similar kind of language in a series of other contexts. An obvious one is, again, the question of Palestine, particularly the idea that Palestinians are not committed to peace, or the idea that certain politicians need to really show that they are devoted to peace. We see something similar, or we saw something similar across the Arab Spring, where different governments, but also different newspapers, different journalists, were placing that demand upon different protesters, saying, well, are you committed to peace or not? Do you love peace? And something similar in the U.S. in Ferguson, and the ways that the public discourse really did seem to frame the question of who's protesting, why people protest, in terms of this question of being peaceful, of loving peace, and thereby smuggling in, I think, all sorts of asymmetries, and also all sorts of ways of masking the political stakes, the political structures. And I think part of what my book wants to argue is masking the ways that these structures have a really deep conceptual history across the canon of political theory.
And that is, of course, my next question. And you do, you know, you do start off, of course, as many of us do, as you said, with Plato. And you start with the laws, which, you know, again, a little bit of a swerve there. But you know, I started talking about the Athenian stranger, and I was brought back to graduate school. But one of the components of your book that I found fascinating and enlightening was that you take the sort of a lot of the traditional Western canon around sort of the political structures and war and peace. I'm going to use the terms together from Plato and Hobbes and so forth. But you also are integrating, as you say, sort of canon adjacent. And in some places, perhaps more embedded in the canon than not, thinkers like Al-Farabi and so forth. And so I would love for you to talk about not only, you know, sort of how these thinkers are understanding the concepts, but also why these particular thinkers that you draw over 2,000 years of political thought, Western and non-Western.
Great. That's a great question. So I start with Plato, and then I go to Al-Farabi and Aquinas, and then to Erasmus and to Ibn Khaldun and Thomas Hobbes, Grotius and Gentili, and Immanuel Kant and Sayyid Qutb. And the main, one of the main reasons that I go with these thinkers is that each of them deploys or plays with or even wrestles with, let's say, the idea that war is for the sake of peace. So there's a kind of refrain, a kind of chorus maybe running through not just the book, but also I want to say the history of political thought, that war is for the sake of peace. And some of the thinkers that treat are more critical of that idea than others. And actually part of what's interesting is how by the time that you get to Grotius, for example, when he says that war is for the sake of peace, he says it as a kind of commonplace, a kind of old piece of wisdom that we all know. And what's interesting there is the extent to which you have people across centuries, people from Plato to Kant and Qutb, citing one another. Oftentimes explicitly. So when I turn to Al-Farabi, I open with his citation through probably Galen of Plato's laws that war is for the sake of peace. Aquinas does something similar, but through Aristotle's commentary on Plato's laws. And when you get to Erasmus, you have him saying, you have all these people saying that war is for the sake of peace, but that's ridiculous, that's impossible. And what we end up with him, of course, at the end is war is indeed for the sake of peace. It just happens to be the kind of war that he ends up sanctioning, that he ends up authorizing in his texts. When you have Hobbes, similarly, the one human desire that goes unchallenged is peace, and it turns out that war is for the sake of peace and security and order. And so basically, it's the repetition of the idea of war is for the sake of peace. It's the citational quality, the kind of like a thread actually ties these different thinkers together. So that rather than accepting, I think, the kinds of periodizations about ancient, modern, contemporary, or Western, non-Western, Western, and Islamic, it's to see these kinds of divisions as ideological constructs first and foremost. They can be useful heuristically, but they have a particular history. So the very way that Al-Farabi, Ibn Khaldun, and Sayyid Qutb are hived off in a way as part of a separate canon or separate canons, that ideological work is part of what the book questions. So the subtitle is indeed Genealogies of a Violent Ideal in Western and Islamic Thought, but both the categories Western and Islamic are ones that I am attempting to not only push against and problematize, but also show that they are part and parcel of different theorizations of war and peace in terms of the provincial structures and in terms of the polemical structures. And I just want to say one thing about the choice for Al-Farabi, Ibn Khaldun, and Sayyid Qutb in particular. Part of my interest in the book, I think at one point in the book, I say this may strike some readers as a project in comparative political theory, be that as it may, it's a kind of project that's trying to be critical of the terms of comparison that we use, so rather than taking them for granted. And when I turn to Al-Farabi, Ibn Khaldun, and Qutb, it's with the I'm asking readers to be also cognizant of the ways that each of these thinkers has come to stand in for a particular figuration of the Muslim, a particular way of thinking of Islam in relation to violence, war, and peace. And here, of course, I'm simplifying a little bit, but only a little bit. Oftentimes, Al-Farabi is treated in political theory as a thinker who had to write in secrets, one who had to write esoterically and in riddles, because the one version of this claim, he had to do this in order to protect himself, because Islam is hostile to critical thinking or something like that. Ibn Khaldun is often treated as the genius philosopher and historian who went unrecognized during his time. And, you know, it's only thanks to the labor of European Orientalists that he was discovered, something along those lines. So one who went unappreciated until the West or Europe fixed that. And Sayyid Qutb has his name has largely come to be synonymous with a certain kind of Islamic violence, a certain kind of Islamic terrorism, a certain kind of Islam as ideology, So whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda, his name is the one that people tend to invoke. So I picked these three deliberately to try to bring these figurations to the foreground, how Al-Farabi, Ibn Khaldun, and Qutb are called upon in order to do this kind of ideological work that the book is pushing against, primarily by demonstrating, on the one hand, other ways of reading these thinkers, more critical ways of reading them, and on the other hand, of showing that these figurations are part and parcel of the idea that whether it's democracies or Europe or the West or America, these are ultimately peace-loving, and that they are the spaces or the sites that can help us think about peace as an aspiration. And that's part of what I'm pushing against. There's all these politics that are, again, there's all these politics that are cooked into this.
And the politics that are cooked into the sort of the entire discussion, I think also, I'm intrigued by the way that you have brought into the conversation the Arabic thinkers, but also that they are part of the conversation. And so it would be a sort of limited conversation without more thinkers involved in it, as you note, in part because all of these thinkers are citing each other with regard to these concepts across space and time. And so I would love for you to talk a little bit about the sort of integration into the sections of the book. You have, you know, you, as you note, there's sort of groupings of thinkers that sort of trace a bit through the history of political thought. But as you note, they're also the ones who have overtly talked about the sort of idea of war for the sake of peace. So can you talk about how you started to knit together these particular thinkers in these sort of groupings?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I like the way that you put it. There's a way that each of the 10 thinkers, and there's a few more that are in the background of the book that I don't treat directly or that aren't named in the table of contents. But each of these 10 thinkers in particular are I don't want to say that they're part of a conversation with one another so much as they should be part of our conversations in thinking about the relationship of the history of political thought or contemporary political theory to theorizations of war, violence, and peace. And part of the structure of the book, or part of the architecture of the chapters, is intended to highlight how we might go about going beyond, in a way, the notion of putting different thinkers either sort of contrasting different thinkers for their different normative value or something that also sometimes happens in political theory, putting thinkers making it seem as though when thinkers are in conversation with one another, that there is something peaceful in a way about that. Where actually part of what I'm trying to recover are the tensions, the antagonisms, the histories of violence that lurk in the theorizations of peace. So I start with Plato in a way to take the discipline of political theory at its word, to say, let us go to Plato's Laws, one of the texts that was indeed cited time and time again, both in Arabic philosophical discourses and also in Latin and in European languages. Then from there to two thinkers who are oftentimes presented in a sense as the Christian and Muslim heirs to a certain kind of Greek world. And that's Aquinas and Al-Farabi. And others who've thought of Al-Farabi and Aquinas together, oftentimes there's a way that the claim has tended to be more about their agreement with one another, or a kind of elevation to a sort of shared status, which again, I think for me, there's something actually depoliticizing, and it elides a lot of the histories of how these thinkers have been treated and why those histories matter for when we read them now. So part of what I try to do is actually read Al-Farabi against the grain and against himself, and then from there extract a series of critiques of how we should think about the idea of just war, of which Aquinas is often presented as one of the foremost thinkers. And oftentimes people try to sort of slide Al-Farabi into some tradition of just war, even though he doesn't actually talk about just war. So then to extract a series of critiques there that help us think of the relationship of just war to intentions. Why is it that intentions are such a big part of the story as opposed to say materiality, or as opposed to the intentions that we don't want to admit to ourselves. In any case, when I go to Erasmus in the chapter after this, it's I treat him on his own in large part because he does have this reputation as being the proto-pacifist. In a way, Erasmus is he's what some colleagues might call like the hard case for the book. Even the proto-pacifist. So what I mean by that is Erasmus is a thinker who is often associated with universal peace. He's someone who contemporary political theorists have sometimes found themselves turning to as an inspiration and a space for solace, in a way that perhaps perhaps he can help us think about religious difference and disagreement in a way that refuses war. Because Erasmus was someone who has a reputation of having been critical of war under any circumstances, supposedly. And part of what I try to show is, I mean, he was really critical of some kinds of war, but there are other kinds of wars, some of which he doesn't want to call wars, others which he does actually give the language of war to, that he champions. And in a way, these aren't inconsistencies. They're not contradictions. Part of my argument throughout the book and for each of these different thinkers is that when they end up justifying or authorizing some kind of violence or some kind of war, this is actually internal to their thinking. It's actually consistent with their assumptions. There may be ambiguities and ambivalences that are built into their theories that open up to both a kind of ostensibly pacific imaginary and a more violent one, but that doesn't mean that we can just put the more violent or warlike one aside. We actually need to take it seriously.
And so you have the sort of the foundational discussion early on, and you also structure the book in an interesting way with these kind of interludes, which I enjoyed. And so I was wondering if you could, you know, sort of talk about the sort of moving, you know, again, moving forward through history, the sort of the next two sort of groupings, but also why you sort of structured the book with these interludes.
Yeah, no, honestly, I had so much fun writing the interludes. so I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed them. In a way, writing a book that tries to go from Plato to Kant and Qutb, it's partly a fool's errand. Like, I'm happy to admit this. It's the kind of breadth is at times it was very unwieldy. And part of what I wanted to avoid in the book is the appearance of seamlessness, because it's not seamless. Going from the polis to the to the city in Arabic and in Latin, going from Al-Farabi all the way to Sayyid Qutb, not only are there centuries, not only are there geographies, but there are also really important epistemic and political shifts that should make us wary, I think, of any kind of jump like that. So the interludes, I wanted them to be opportunities for me, for the reader, to take a step back, but also to look at the conceptual architecture that that sort of animated both the preceding chapters and the next chapters from a kind of different vantage point, from a different view. Looking at a different aspect of it. And so these were places where I wanted to say, hey, the idea of advising for peace, the idea of someone who's an advisor for peace, or the idea of friendship, the idea of the neighbor, these are important in these other sets of ways, going from Plato to Al-Farabi and Aquinas and Erasmus. The idea of friendship continues with Erasmus, and then it kind of, I mean, it's really interesting, it kind of drops out of theorizations of peace in the history of political thought, and friendship kind of becomes depoliticized. I wanted to mark that. In the second interlude, I do something similar as well, where part of what I want to say is there are different threads, maybe is a good way of putting it. There are different threads woven through the tapestries of history that bind these different thinkers and their ideas together in through these additional layers, in a way. So the figure of the pirate, or the figure of the nomad, the figure of the sovereign, that these end up doing different kinds of work, both in the writings of the thinkers in the book and in the writings of other thinkers around them. Vattel is someone that I mention specifically as being important for the idea that certain states come to be seen as pirates and therefore can be bombarded as pirates. And it's also to point to how the different historical episodes around which some of these figurations and some of these concepts crystallize are ones of immense violence, but immense violence that was indeed in the name of peace. So I see these interludes as really as taking a step back and then showing the reader a series of other threads or a series of other entry points into how to think about the relationship of these thinkers to one another, these chapters to one another, and the relationship of peace to different structures of violence as well. So the chapters in, let's say, the second half of the book, we have Grotius and Gentili, two thinkers that are fundamental to the idea that law, and specifically international law, or how, let's say, the law of nations comes to be translated into international law, how that is a force for peace or a structure for thinking through peace, when actually it, part of my argument is it, the process of turning peace into a legal concept hives off a series of other possibilities for thinking about peace. And it ends up treating war and peace as these kinds of juridical ideas that can only ever be recognized or adjudicated from the perspective of the law. So there's something actually almost like a kind of expropriation. There's something kind of dispossessing about the elevation of law there. With Hobbes and Ibn Khaldun, I was interested in how we have these two thinkers who are, at the end of the day, I want to say, theorists of theorists of history, power, and what we might call the state, of how a state is founded, how the state is founded through a moment of might, oftentimes might that comes from the outside. And yet they give us such a different view of frontiers and from part of what I argue in that chapter of settler colonialism and the relationship of peace to the violence of settler colonialism. And then in the last chapter, this is probably the this is sort of the most fun of the juxtapositions, let's say, where I invite readers to think about Immanuel Kant, the philosopher of perpetual peace through a Pacific federation. And Sayyid Qutb, the so-called ideologue of Islamist terror, who also called for a federation or an Islamic bloc of states, as actually sharing a certain set of political horizons, or let's say being constrained by a similar set of discursive and political horizons. And then very briefly in the epilogue, I try to extract some possibilities, some other ways of thinking about peace. And I want to flag that one of those takes us back to the beginning of our conversation today. And it's the possibility of thinking about peace on its own, the possibility of not treating peace as an ideal, but rather treating it as a political idea with all that that entails.
And I mean, that's really the biggest difficulty, I think, in reading through your analysis and your careful consideration of so many thinkers and so many perspectives, that I concluded it's like, yeah, I don't think about it conceptually pretty much on its own. And what does it take to imagine that conceptually, which is very difficult in terms of being a theorist, and in terms of also how does that look and function in our contemporary political situations? You have been an amazing guide through unpacking the concept, and how so many political theorists have, in fact, tried to get at it. But you've also left me a little bit anxious, perhaps. Which is fine. I mean,
yeah, no, mission accomplished.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, no, I think that one of the, so this is actually the nicest thing to hear that I've made you anxious. Sorry. One of the aims of the book is, I think, to really bring to the fore what you called what you just described as a kind of anxiety about peace, what I would want to say is about really remembering and or perhaps not even remembering, but never forgetting, which I think is importantly different. Never forgetting that there is a disturbing way that peace operates, that appeals to peace operate, that both as a idea and ideal, and also as a discursive artifact that we often hear invoked and appealed to across political spectrums, across contexts, and certainly this isn't exclusive to any particular ideological position. I think some are worse than others, but, or some are more guilty than others, let's say. But I think that this is where the one of the reasons that I end the book with these three paragraphs, one of each of which is about these other ways of trying to think about peace. On the one hand, it's a challenge, and I think it's a real challenge, whether we can train ourselves to think about to be critical whenever we hear someone say peace and development, or peace and justice, or peace and order, or peace and security, to really look more closely at the work that peace there is being made to do, vis-a-vis the oftentimes unstated forms of violence, war, coercion, and hierarchy that are being called upon, and in terms of the sanitizing work that peace is doing vis-a-vis these other ideas surrounding it. In terms of training ourselves to be more concrete when we talk about peace, to talk about the particular context this peace or that peace rather than peace in this kind of abstract, general way that I think ends up serving certain kinds of political interests over others. And similarly, trying to think about how we oftentimes treat peace as being about agreement, being about kind of coming together, being a certain kind of harmony. But it's also to recognize that there are certain situations that have violence that we can come to think of as peace. So in other words, it's to take peace down from being an ideal to being a political idea diagnostically as well in how we think about the world. It's to understand that sometimes, and not always, obviously, but sometimes rather than agreement, what's necessary is a responsible kind of separation. Sometimes what's necessary is a certain kind of silence. The peace isn't always through dialogue. And sometimes it's actually not peace that we should be looking at. Sometimes it's really justice, and it might have demands that are not at all peaceful.
And I mean, I think that's one of the careful things that you do in this book is to take the concept peace, and you state this early on, but I think you're very careful in the writing that peace, the way you are exploring it and putting it into a rigorous analysis, is a political concept as opposed to a moral one. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important in terms of thinking about the concept on its own, mm-hmm. But also where we also want to have it.
Yeah.
And I think that's, it's one of the very careful things that you do throughout the book, that made me, again, sort of think about what I'm trying to conceptualize with this word.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. The, in a way, the book is an invitation to think about peace not as a moral ideal, or at least not purely in the realm of morality. And I think that it is indeed the case that it's often treated purely in this way, sometimes cynically, but part of my argument in the book is that it's not purely cynically, that there's something in the history of the concept that has invited people to, has invited theorists, political actors, and their readers as well, to conceptualize peace as though it's what defines the human, as though it is an absolute ideal, when part of what I'm asking readers to take seriously is the idea that peace is not outside of politics, meaning it is not outside of power, meaning it is not outside of the outside of questions surrounding violence, hierarchy, their justification, their sanitization, and the different histories through which some are included and others are excluded, and in which certain inclusions actually end up being more violent than certain exclusions. So it's really to think about peace critically, the way that actually political theorists have tended to be happy to do with other ideas. And that's part of what was surprising when I was reading around in contemporary political theory, the history of political thought. We in political theory had treated all sorts of ideas, all sorts of ideals in this kind of critical fashion. And yet, peace seemed to be untroubled. And it was interesting because it was almost as though you're confronted with one of two things. Either peace is a kind of moral ideal and we just leave it that way, or, and I mentioned this in the introduction to the book as well, you have all these thinkers from Tacitus to the present, who, in like one sentence or two sentences, Heidegger, I think, is the clearest indication of this, but in one sentence or two sentences will say, hey, there's something really strange about how people invoke peace and then they go to war. Huh. And then there's a kind of, in the book, I call it a kind of shrug, and then they just kind of either move on or they say, well, but you know, that's a misuse. That's an abuse. That's not really peace doing that work. So either you're left with peace as a moral ideal, or you're left with it being re-entrenched as a moral ideal because these other ways of thinking about it, these other ways of using it, because it's actual moral, social, and political life, ends up being treated as epiphenomenal or peripheral to its existence. And that was surprising. And it's what I mean when I say that peace is a troubling ideal, but it has remained untroubled.
Yes, and that was one of the points that I was sort of surprised by, but then obviously made lots of sense as I read your work, was that it was in fact untroubled because people just shrugged and went on. And you were like, oh yeah, they did.
Yeah, no, Heidegger is, I think, the funniest on this one. He says, maybe I shouldn't say funny, it's Heidegger. With a wink, with a wink, the nations are informed that this coming war is going to be the one that's for peace. And then he says, something is really out of joint here. How is peace going to be secured by the very thing that it's supposed to eliminate? I don't understand. Anyway. And I'm like, anyway?
Of course. So with that, Murad, what are you working on now? You sort of made a little passing reference to it.
Ah, yes. I'm working on a book that picks up actually from where this one ends. So it's the working title is Islam Out of History, Genealogies of Political Order and Linguistic Disorder. And one of the chapters is a genealogy, a different kind of genealogy than the one in this book, a genealogy of how peace comes to be identified with Islam, or rather how the very meaning of the word Islam comes to be either peace or the opposite of peace. And I'm interested in this project in thinking about the politics of language and the kinds of ordinary tropes that recur both in the history of political thought and also in contemporary discourses that turn Islam into a subject, into an agent, primarily in a kind of liberal imaginary. So the idea that Islam is a religion of peace, the idea that Islam needs a Martin Luther, and the idea that Muslims need to understand jihad in a purely spiritual manner, trying to give the histories of these, but then also the ways that they've been productive for the history of political thought in ways that perhaps we don't always acknowledge. And then the possibilities for thinking differently, the more critical terrain that these ways of thinking about Islam and peace, reformation, and pacification, how there's actually critical possibilities that we need to take seriously.
Will you come on the New Books in Political Science podcast and talk to me about it once it comes out?
I would love to.
Excellent.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. So today I was joined by Murad Idris, who is the author of War for Peace, Genealogies of a Violent Ideal in Western and Islamic Thought. This is published by Oxford University Press in 2019, and I assume it's available at the Oxford University Press website as well as other places.
Yes, and
thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Lily. This was a really great conversation. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.